Looking for answers in the jobs report. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. We're getting a big tip-off about the overall health of the U.S. economy today, the Labor Department's employment report for November. October's report was great. The economy added 250,000 jobs, unemployment held at 3.7%. A lot changed in one short month. Financial markets became more volatile. The housing market started to slow down. Point is, we'll be looking closely at the November jobs report for maybe some reassurance that things will be okay or not. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Weekly jobless claims are up over the past month, and company layoff announcements are significantly higher than last year. Still, there are 7 million job openings in the economy right now, and unemployment's at a near 50-year low. If hiring does slow in coming months, it could be because of employers' increasing difficulty finding qualified workers, says Joe Galvin at advisory firm Vistage.
66% of small and mid-sized businesses are currently actively looking to hire. That means that everybody's looking for the best people. The problem is the best people have jobs.
So employers are offering higher pay to retain their workers. Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter says rising corporate indebtedness could eventually sap the job market.
Industries to watch for signs of flagging hiring are the financial sector, real estate, manufacturing, energy, telecommunication, and retail.
The job market is typically a lagging recession indicator. So by the time unemployment rises and job creation falls off, the good times are likely already over. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is up 1.4%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are down in the 0.5% range, with the Dow future down 110 points. The 10-year Treasury yield is at 2.89%. Sears might not be dead. You might remember the famous American department store filed for bankruptcy in October, and things looked pretty grim. Now the current chairman is offering to buy what's left of the retail chain. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that.
When Eddie Lampert bought Sears 13 years ago in a merger with Kmart, he was hailed as the next Warren Buffett. But he oversaw the downward spiral of the company and led it into bankruptcy in October when he stepped down as CEO but remained chairman. In a securities filing yesterday, he proposed a $4.6 billion bid to save what's left of the 130-year-old retailer. Philip Emma is a retail bankruptcy expert with DebtWire. He says the first hurdle is getting approval from Sears creditors and the bankruptcy judge. They might choose liquidation over salvaging a handful of stores that looked profitable in October, but
it doesn't necessarily mean they're profitable when they get through the Christmas season.
Retail expert Bert Flickinger of the Strategic Resource Group says brands like the Kenmore appliances might still be worth saving, but he doesn't believe the former CEO is the one to do it.
Lampert has no retail experience, not as an operator, not as a merchant.
Flickinger says Sears was positioned to compete with Amazon, but instead Lampert presided over years of losses. History, even a Kenmore spin cycle, can't make shiny. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is on a mission that drives what we do every day to increase the economic intelligence of all of us. But we can't do it alone. Become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount you choose, and your donation will go twice as far, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate today at marketplace.org.
Chinese tech executive Meng Wanzhou is due in Canadian court for a bail hearing later today. Her arrest was a sign, in the words of Eurasia Group, that the gloves are now fully off in the conflicts between the U.S. and China over trade, intellectual property, and Iran sanctions. Well, you can add one more arena to that list of conflicts, semiconductor microchips. Tim Cross is science and technology correspondent for The Economist and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
A lot of the trade war that we've heard about so far has been about steel, aluminum, soybeans, manufacturing. But more important than all of these, you argue, are computer chips. Why?
I think for a couple of reasons. I think one is increasingly computer chips are like steel, they're like aluminum, in that they are sort of on their way to becoming like a fundamental part of the global economy. Increasingly, they go into everything. They're also very, very hard to make, and they have big implications for national security and for military power.
Well, to that point, the U.S. has been competing with China, trying to slow China down from catching up with the U.S. even before the trade war. They banned Intel from selling top-end chips to Chinese labs. Is that effective?
It's maybe effective in the short term. What's harder to know is whether it'll be effective in the long term. And the example you gave about Intel chips, that's right. They did ban them. But until very recently, the world's fastest supercomputer was a Chinese machine that very unusually was built out of chips that were designed in China. And so, the ban probably did have some kind of an effect, but one of those effects was just to sort of spur the Chinese into trying even harder to develop their own silicon to replace what Intel could have provided.
So as the U.S. and China are sort of fighting it out on all these different levels, government and industry, what's the potential implication of this rivalry for all the companies in the world that need semiconductor chips for pretty much everything?
Well, I think the main implication is it makes things very uncertain. So particularly the sort of cutting edge chips, the kind you find in things like smartphones or in the big computing clouds that companies like Google and Amazon are building, the supply chain that builds them is kind of incredibly complicated, very international, and it's stuffed full of these kind of hyper-specialized firms. Each does one little tiny bit of this process. You know, you've got this sort of planetary-scale supply chain. If you try and disrupt it, that's going to be disruptive for everyone, for the people who are involved in that supply chain, for people who depend on its products. And I guess it depends, you know, how bad things get and how fierce the rivalry is. But you could see, the pace of innovation could slow down. You could see rising costs. You could see lots of disruption as people feel like they're sort of forced to quit markets or to reduce their exposure. I think, potentially, depending on how high the temperature goes, it could be pretty disruptive.
Tim Cross is science and technology correspondent for The Economist. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.